It's time to get brutally honest.
You know, if I'm Estrada, I might be thinking, I got to play this out. If I'm the Jays, I don't even know what you would be offering him because you'd have to lowball him based on his numbers this year. And if you're going to lowball him, what's the point of having the conversation? Because chances are he's going to say, you know what, forget it.
This is Overdrive on TSN 1050.
Final hour, Overdrive continues. The world is still intact. The eclipse is come and gone. Trump stared right at it without the stupid-looking glasses. And I guess he's okay. So the world goes on, Dave.
Let's let the science dudes who made hay off this eclipse by having eclipse conniptions all over media for the past week. Let's hope they go back to their basements for a while. I don't want to see them. Fellas, if there's aliens approaching, if there are asteroids afoot, let me know. But I don't want to hear about another non-event that's turned into an event.
How about the eclipse parties?
That's what I'm saying.
Like, who went to an eclipse party? What are you doing with your life Monday afternoon?
Seriously. Like, I was reading some of these stories, people first-personing their eclipse party. You know, come on, making the cereal box eclipse viewing mechanism out of tinfoil and mirrors and cereal boxes and tape. Is this really, what it's come down to, Hayes?
Like, well, it is. I mean, and in the era of social media, it's just another opportunity to explain why we're doomed. Humanity is doomed because we're just all so stupid and we're all idiots because people are posting pictures of them looking like playing eclipse roulette, like challenging the sun. Like, I'm going to stare at this thing and then post an Instagram story, and I might go blind in like a couple of days, or I may have the spots for the rest of my life.
Yes.
But it's worth it because this bad boy is going to hit like 125 views in the next hour.
I'm going to get lots of likes on this one. Can you believe this?
Like, I do believe it.
I believe it.
2017, Trump stared at the thing without the glasses.
Well, I could believe that.
That I really believe.
That I could see.
It's the best.
It's one of the great... It's going to make the highlight reel of Trump footage.
It really has to,
because, like,
it?
With the aide in the background, with the audio where he's saying, don't look up, and Trump is looking right up.
Well, it's kind of like the good old days of harmless Trump.
Yeah.
Like, he's still... At the core of him, he was what he was, but there used to be like some buffoonery. It was like the early days of the Rob Ford administration, where he'd run into cameras,
right,
or he'd attempt a five-step drop and he'd blow a wheel. And Trump, now he's got his hands in the cookie jar of the whole world, and it's a lot more serious. But there were times where he would say or do stupid things, and you could laugh at it. This would be one of them. Ultimately harmless, except for his own sight, but it doesn't affect the world.
Well, let's hope not.
Well, that's true, I guess. If he can't see properly, who knows if he'll be reading those dossiers from the intelligence community. I don't know.
He's skimming them the best as it is. I mean, so let's be honest.
Well, I read this morning that I guess that's... He only seeks out intelligence that... fit his narrative. So he doesn't want to be told, like, hey, actually, even though you don't believe it, this is kind of going on, or maybe we wanted to enlighten you on what's happening domestically with terrorism as opposed to overseas.
You know, that global warming thing, there are some scientists that believe there's something to it.
Yeah, that's not in his wheelhouse. Seeking out that kind of information.
He doesn't want to hear that one.
Anyway, Dirk Ayers will join us here in a moment. The Jays got swept over the weekend. I guess some people are holding on for dear life. I said on Friday, there's no kids that you're waiting to see in September. The MLB draft is a crapshoot at the best of times anyway. And
well,
yeah, there would it be better at this point to pick 5th as opposed to pick 10th? Yes, it would be. I'm not denying that. But there's still 38 games to play that out. Coming into this weekend, I wasn't in a position of, hey, lose as many as you can so you can move up and maybe get a stud, the 5th pick, as opposed to whether or not he's on the board at 7 or 8. So you might as well believe in it. You've gone this far. They're a veteran-laden team. At one point, they were 3 out of a wild card spot. Go for it. Have the belief. I wasn't going to chastise people for that. But now, surely, you have to step away, even if you are the most optimistic Blue Jay fan on earth and realize they're done. I mean, they're five out. They've never been 500 all year. There's 38 games left. If you use the 85 win barometer for that second wild card spot, they've got to go 26-12 over the final 38 games.
Yeah.
This weekend, you can't get swept when you put yourself in this position. You can't.
It's not happening. We all know it's not happening. You'd have to reel off a crazy, crazy streak. And they just haven't shown any ability to do that, right? They haven't put together streaks. This isn't a team that's been able to just get hot and turn it on and flip a switch and become a world beater. So we all know it's not going to happen. And yet, they're not bad enough to really be excited about their draft possibility, because I think right now they'd pick something like 10th if the season wrapped up today. So they're not tanking. They're not contending. They're in that mushy middle that isn't very satisfying for anybody.
Well, and then you look at what happened yesterday, and they don't have many bright spots on this team. They haven't this year. They haven't had many sure things. It was evident again this weekend. If you don't have Stroman pitching in a series, it's potentially death.
Yeah.
And it was this weekend. Estrada was okay, but he's got to be better than that, considering the way he's been pitching all year. Now his ERA is north of 5 again. Happ pitched fine, but Tepish, that was inevitable. Mm-hmm. Rowley's going to run into trouble. I mean, at least 40%, if not 60% of the rotation, if you include Estrada in that, is a crapshoot. The only guy you are certain of, for the most part, is Marcus Stroman. Another guy was Roberto Osuna for at least a portion of the season.
Yes.
Had a very up-and-down year, started the year on the DL, came off it, struggled to find some rhythm, but at one point executed on 22 straight save opportunities.
Yeah.
Became an all-star, had great numbers. Recently, he's really struggled. Now he leads the league in blown saves. And a lot of times that is the number that you really should be focusing on in terms of success, because every team has a different amount of opportunities. Closers come in sometimes when it's not a save opportunity. If you blow saves, that number screams at me as a fan a lot more than actually converting on the save. And yesterday, Rafi Lopez behind the plate had his issues. That's not up for debate. I mean, there were a couple of pass balls, at least one that probably he could have blocked. We know the one ball that got away from him, and then he didn't throw it to first on time. He was holding the runner at third for some reason. But that's more on Osuna.
Yeah.
I mean, Osuna's the pro. Yeah, he's a young guy, but he's been in this role for a few years. And he came in, and you could tell he just did not have his stuff.
Right, and we saw, you know, something we don't see, just John Gibbons going up to the mound, essentially chastising his young pitcher to say, what are you doing? Why aren't you attacking these hitters? Why are you nibbling? Why aren't you giving them the gas and getting us out of here with this two-run lead? We haven't seen that. I don't recall Gibbons having to go out there and do that to Osuna. And that, to me, that brings up a troubling question. Like, what's wrong with the kid's confidence if he's going out there and not just throwing heat and doing what he does and keeping it simple and exiting Wrigley Field with a win instead of leaving with a disappointing loss and his eighth blown save of the year? And you're right, that you think about those eight blown saves, Hayes, which lead the major leagues. You tack those eight blown saves and project those as eight wins. You add them to the 59 they've got. You got 68 wins. You're ahead of the Yankees all of a sudden. You know, you're right in the American League wild card hunt. You are currently sitting in the first wild card.
So, you don't feel dejected the way they do right now.
And look, it's not unheard of for elite closers to go 100% all season.
Wade Davis is doing it right now in Chicago. Yeah. Zach Britton did it a year ago.
I mean,
you have to be truly elite. Truly locked in.
But
you need some luck at the same time.
You do. But there's been guys who've gone 95. Many guys go 90, 95%. Right now, Asuna's at 80% in his conversion rate, which is, frankly, not acceptable for a contending team.
Let's bring in Dirk Hayhurst in this Baseball Insider. Is brought to you by Oakland Ford Lincoln, your premier source for auto service and sales in the GTA. We were talking about Osuna's outing yesterday and the fact that Gibbons had to come out and kind of read the riot act to him and basically demand he start throwing heat. I mean, challenge batters. You're up two. It's the 10th inning. You're fresh. You're prepared. You've been in this position before. And yet what preceded that was Osuna not really challenging batters. What do you make of that mentality from Osuna, and why he put himself in that position where it didn't look like he was intending on challenging the Cubs?
Well, actually, if you look at some of the data over this last 30-day stretch, and I think you could probably go back farther than that, you'll see that Osuna has kind of backed off of the fastball. Now, I'm not sure why that is. I'm not sure if there's pain associated with that. I'm not sure if he, too, is having a finger issue and he just doesn't want to say anything about it at this juncture. It could be a myriad of things. But over the course of his career now, during the middle portion of the year, you start to see this shift to off-speed pitches. Not a dramatic one. It's not like a huge spike in the data here, but there has been a transition to that off-speed stuff. And one has to wonder if this isn't someone reacting to a perceived reaction to him. And what I mean by that is, you know, baseball's a data-heavy game. And as seasons go on and you get a look at a guy who really throws a ton of fastballs in high-leverage situations, you kind of get this feeling like there's only so many times I'm going to be able to sneak this fastball by a guy. Right, but the thing about Osuna is that he's got a good fastball. It's got a lot of life on it. It's got giddy up right at the top of that barrel. So he catches a lot of guys in the high and tight, and he can execute down and away with this off-speed stuff. But when you show the off-speed too many times, it doesn't matter how good it is. It becomes less good just by virtue of oversaturation. Now, this isn't just an Osuna thing. This happens to a lot of guys. And I just want to throw this out there, okay? The bread and butter number for closers, and I think that history has shown this for closers, is that if you have the lead going into the ninth inning, you should be able to convert the save on average over 95% of the time. Just by virtue of not imploding or like outthinking yourself, but just going out there and pitching what appears to be a successful clean inning, you should be able to convert it. I mean, I'm just putting balls on the ground, relying on defense, whatever it is. Now, another thing I want to throw on top of the Osuna thing, guys, is that, you know, you talked about Zach Britton, okay? The guys that are having these phenomenal seasons, these incredible closers, they also have really good defense behind them. And I'm not trying to lay – I mean, Osuna hasn't been himself. Walks are an issue. Getting hit is an issue. But there is a point in time when you can say you've had clutch defensive saviors out there behind you. And right now you got Troy Tulowitzki on the shelf. You got players playing out of position. You got Jose Bautista, he's not in right field, or when he is out there, you know, he's a liability. You've just got a subpar offense behind a high leverage arm right now, and I'm not saying it counts for all eight of those blown saves, but I think you could realistically give him back two of those saves if you had the kind of defense behind him that some of these other teams with closers that go wire to wire have. They've got great stuff. But even great stuff needs somebody to save its ass every once in a while out there on the ball diamond. And I think if you have a better defense wire to wire, you might have a better conversation around this young man.
So, Dirk, it's interesting you talk about that. I'm looking at some of his pitch stats, and when you, it is really stark, the way he's gone away from the fastball in 2017. I think in 2016 he was throwing 61% fastballs. This year it's more like 35% fastballs, and he's obviously increased his cutter, his use of the cutter. But I'm wondering, you know, you talked about the possibility maybe he's injured, but the idea that Gibbons would go out there and sort of chastise him and say, let's attack here, let's not nibble. I mean, does that maybe speak to more of a mental thing with Osuna?
Well, I think there's a point in time where, like, you give a guy benefit of the doubt, right? He struggles, you go out there with kid gloves, especially when it's a high-leverage situation. You're going to go out there and you're going to try and, you know, all right, you know, we have a job to do. I believe in you. You're a winner. You're a tiger. You're going to be somebody. You know, that kind of stuff. That rhetoric means a lot, especially when you trust a guy's ability to execute and he just can't find it, you know, and you want him to bear down. But I think Osuna is past the point now where you go out there and you try to be nice about it. You know, you got a job to do, and your job is to get your head out of your ass. However it got there, I don't know, and I don't care. I don't care. You got good stuff. Throw it over the plate. Stop beating yourself. You know, and that starts to become that line. And look, I've been out there in far lower leverage situations with this young man, and I've had the manager come out and read me the riot act for being a colossal, you know, screw-up. So, I mean, that's just, you know, that was most of my career. So I'm used to this, but I have to tell you, you know, at some point in time, you need a guy to just get angry and stop thinking and start just throwing the hell out of the ball and see how easy the game can be again. And for some people who get stuck in their own mind, and I'm not taking this back to Osuna's bout with mental illness or his forever bout with mental illness, really, with anxiety and depression, but I am saying that sometimes you just need to smack them in the face, focus clear-eyed on the present and execute the next five or six pitches, and you'd be amazed if you can just live in that moment for that long how many positive results you can generate.
With Dirk Hayhurst, our Jays analyst, Ryan Tepera has been a bright spot, one of the very few bright spots this year for this team, and I think he factors into this conversation because of how he's essentially been set up as the setup guy, and yet he doesn't have the track record that Osuna does. I mean, he was relatively unknown, not much expectations coming into this season. How would you play this out the rest of the way? Would you just stick to Osuna regardless of how everything's playing out, or would you want to give Tepera a shot in that closing role just to see what he can maybe bring?
I think you give him a shot. I say that for multiple reasons. One, because if you're going to try it, you have a justified reason to do it to Osuna right now. And you may say that that's not a big issue. If a guy's not performing, you take him out of his position. But you know how baseball players get hung up on roles, titles, and how if they're not batting in the right order, they get all pissy pants about it. And if they're not in the ninth inning, then it's, you know, it's major upheaval and it's, you know, my role. Like, this stuff happens. And so there is a bit of a psychological element, in which case it has to be justified why you're doing what you're doing. You know, and a guy losing his closer's position for a bullpen arm is a huge blow. It's significant. It's similar to when a starter who only ever sees himself as a starter gets demoted to the bullpen. It's that kind of psychological impact. And for Osuna, it's going to be a big knock to the ego. And maybe it's deservedly so, because after all, at the end of the day, this is survival. The second thing is, what the hell are the Jays really playing for right now? I mean, they're basically just trying to stay afloat, hoping that somebody else, like, drowns before they do. Because it's been that kind of season for most of the league. The Turtle Derby is still in full swing, okay? So I think if you want to see what – and this is the time that you do it. When you're in last place, you see what other assets you have in your organization and how you can develop around them while you retool yourself. So it's a natural evolution of a bad situation.
So, Dirk, back to another topic about the umpire-player wars that are going on in Major League Baseball. Obviously, Ian Kinsler was suspended. He was fined $10,000 for his comments about Angel Hernandez back on Monday. I guess, obviously, Kinsler talked about how Hernandez needed to find another job. Very, very subtle criticism of the umpire. And of course, the umpires on the weekend took to protesting their treatment with those, you know, somewhat bizarre white armbands they were wearing.
How long did that last?
Didn't last long. I think they lost them in the wash or something the second night. What do you make of this, Dirk? And is there a solution to the never ending war between the umpires and the rest of us?
Is there a solution? Yeah, they could find another job. I think Kinsler nailed that one. You know, look, I've always kind of resented Major League umpires in the respect that it's like a Supreme Court judge job, right? You don't have to stay in primo condition. You don't have to be able to run around the field in a respectable amount of time. You just have to be there and not, you know, not like explode out there on the field. And even sometimes umpires fail to not make giant asses of themselves out there. Like, I think Ian Kinsler's right. Angel Hernandez is a terrible umpire. He has been terrible since I've been in the league. He's been terrible before I got there. Okay. I mean, I knew guys that used to tell me, hands down, this guy is legitimately the worst umpire in all of Major League Baseball. And you would be inclined to say, okay, overpaid prima donna who thinks that everybody's out to get him, I can't take your criticism seriously because you're always going to say that the guy who doesn't give you your call sucks. But the truth of the matter is that guys, there's enough of them in the major league that are pretty unbiased judge of their own ability. Like, there's some guys that are mad they feel like they get robbed. And maybe it's close, and I can see, you know, getting the stink eye at these dudes, like when Jose Bautista has his legendary scowl face on at umpires. But there are a lot of guys that wouldn't be good if they thought they were always right.
Right.
They have to be sober evaluators of their own ability. And when you look at someone like Angel Hernandez, and you look at some of those, I mean, he's just made some bad calls. He really has. And you've got an overwhelming amount of people that play on different teams across generations saying, this guy's terrible. He needs to find another job. Maybe maybe he should find another job. And you know, $10,000, that's $5,000 more than Rougned Odor got fined for punching Jose Bautista in the face. So I know words hurt, but they don't hurt twice as much as getting punched in the head.
Yeah, well, you know, Brad Osmus said it was the Tigers manager said it was an unheard of fine. Never seen a player in his memory fined that much for essentially words, as you say, in a press conference. I mean, what do you mean? Is there a way to just, you know, find a way to find middle ground here? Because it seems to me the umpires do take a lot of abuse in this era because we microanalyze them with HDTV. Where does the middle ground lie?
Well, let me ask you. I mean, what's the net out gain that you get from players not yelling at umpires anymore? And they've always yelled at them. And in previous times, when you have the microphone technology, the HD camera, the lip reading ability, you didn't get to see or hear some of the things that players have said to these umpires. I mean, it was way worse in years past before this stuff was out there, the kind of undressing they would get. You know, I'm sure there's still those moments, but I don't think they're anywhere near as bad as they used to be in the past. And quite frankly, you know, it's a cushy job. It really is a great job. And I feel like, you know, I'm not trying to say like it justifies abuse, but if someone tells you you're bad at what you do and you need to find another job, hello, that's like what you get told as a player every time you suck. I would know, okay?
But Dirk, isn't Major League Baseball, you know, we do know they're evaluating these guys, right? I mean, do you really think they'd let a guy continue on if he was really missing the amount of calls that players seem to think he's missing? Do you think maybe the players overblow one guy's weaknesses because of a few, you know, high profile, you know, blowups?
Yeah, I've had this conversation before with umpires. Actually, the umpires union came in to talk to members of the Tampa Bay Rays when we were in spring training together. So it's me and Joe Maddon and the whole crew in there. And of course, there's the one vociferous outspoken individual who has no time on the Tampa Rays organization. And it's me. And umpires are talking about how we're really not that bad. You know, we only miss a handful of calls out of the hundreds of calls that we have to make every night. And I said, that's great, but those numbers are lying because you could miss the important ones and get all the non-important ones right. You know, it matters when you make the wrong call. If you're making the wrong call in high-pressure situations or when a game is on the line or, I mean, like, when high-leverage scenarios, if this is, then you're not that good. The average means nothing to me. You know, you got the bulk of the ones right down the middle correct, good for you, you know, but you missed all the other ones? Like, I don't care. So those are things that I'm concerned about, and I do get it. Look, I mean, you're never going to get rid of this. You're never going to get rid of this contentious relationship that they have until you introduce robots into the whole thing. And players don't want that. Honestly, they just want someone to yell at. And you get paid enough to get yelled at by guys. You can put up with it. Believe me.
Thank you, Dirk. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
Dirk Hayhurst, our Baseball Insider, brought to you by Oakland Ford Lincoln. Quick Lane, conveniently located at 570 Trafalgar Road in Oakville. I think the umps have more of a beef with technology than the players.
Yeah.
Like, directly the players. Because I think they understand they're being ridiculed all the time and in live time. And people at home are looking at it and saying, wait a minute, that was a half inch outside. How could you screw that up? And I think that's on us as viewers. Like, when did we get to a point where not only do we expect perfection, we demand perfection.
Yeah.
Like, we demand it now. Like, how could you miss that? Like, really?
It's very true.
It's a quarter inch off the plate. Who cares if his strike zone is a little bit different than the perfectly symmetrical square that's on TV?
Yeah. I mean,
you know, like, that's on us.
It's as though it's a big news flash that calling balls and strikes isn't an exact science.
When they're like, going 100 miles an hour, like, or mean, moving with significant English.
That's the thing. I mean, people have a hard time accepting anything less than perfection.
It's on us.
And it's on us. And it really is. And I think, like, Dirk talking about how the umpires have a cushy job. I mean, I have to disagree. Like, I can't think of a more terrifying job. Like, I would not want that job.
I think if you're behind the plate, it's terrifying.
Yeah.
When you're a part of the other rotation where you're sitting at third for an afternoon, that's a cushy job.
But then you got to hop to action and make a really difficult decision in split second time
on a foul ball or fair ball
that will be scrutinized in HDTV by every sports fan in America if you happen to make a bad decision.
True, but there are many games where you don't have to do that.
Sure.
Where if you're down the first or third baseline, maybe you have to chime in on a check swing a couple of times, but outside of that you're sitting there like, "Nah. That's a cushy gig." But that doesn't, you don't sit at third for 162 games. You go through the cycle and you're going to be behind plate, home plate, and that is a highly stressful job.
I'll tell you what, though.
And you never get credit for anything. You just get ridiculed.
And they do stuff outside the game, too. Like, these guys are the NBA refs, the NHL refs, the MLB umpires, and the NFL refs. They've all got to look at video and scrutinize their own calls and explain why they blow calls internally to their supervisors. There's a lot of paperwork and video work. I mean, I'm not like, look, I get as incensed as anybody when you see just a blatantly bad call. But these are not easy gigs. I'm telling you, these are not cushy gigs to my eye.
Well, and it's never going to be perfect, but on TV, we have the ability to break it down as if it should be.
Yeah.
Right? And that's why my whole beef with instant replay, not even instant replay, but with just the review process in baseball and more so in hockey, where it's at such a crazier pace, the idea that you stop the game and break down an offside to the millimeter
is just
ludicrous. And it's a waste of time. And I don't believe the average fan pays for a ticket or invests time in a game at home because they really care if a guy 45 seconds earlier was a millimeter offside. No,
and that's
they don't care.
That's just a classic case of what happens when you really don't think through a rule change, right? When you really don't think it through and decide, how is this really going to affect the game?
Or you actually invest in what the minority is yelling about.
Yeah.
You listen to those three idiots on Twitter who tweeted at NHL and said, do this or I'm out. Meanwhile, 95% of viewers are like, I don't really care.
Nobody was asking for offside to be parsed by the millimeter. Nobody wanted that. And now we realize that it's hard to find a way to get around it because you've instituted the rule and the commissioner says it's working exactly as intended.
Of course he would. Of course he's going to commit to that. We've been talking about it throughout the afternoon. The NHL Network came out with their list of the top 20 centers going into this upcoming season. We'll tell you where Matthews landed on that list next. All right, time now for our best bets brought to you by ProLine. I'm on the Dodgers tonight. When do you not bet for the Dodgers to win? And under the number, Oakland, Baltimore. Under the number, Boston, Cleveland. Throwing out 20 and you can score 88. You can find my picks on Twitter at TSN 1050 Radio and get way into the game with ProLine. It's the sports betting game that lets you turn small wagers into big excitement. ProLine, get way into the game. All right, the NHL season, not right around the corner, but camps are going to open in less than a month. And the NHL Network, the Hockey News, any media outlet that exclusively talks hockey, they've been struggling this summer because it has not been a great summer for hockey content. There's not been a lot going on over the past month. And you get a lot of different lists, a lot of different projections. We do one down here at TSN. I'm sure you guys do a lot of that at the Star, where guys are going to filter in over the course of this upcoming season. And mm-hmm. the NHL Network just unveiled what they believe will be the top 20 centers this upcoming season, or the top 20 going into the season. Now, what has become clear to me and is absolutely not debatable is McDavid and Crosby are clearly the top two centers in the league.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start debating who is number three. I think you'd argue, most would argue, I would argue, it's a three-man race in terms of who is the best player in the game. I would throw Erik Karlsson in there, too. When Karlsson's on the top of his game, I think it's McDavid, Crosby, Karlsson, and then you debate who is the fourth best player in the world. But as for this list, the top 20 centers, it went McDavid 1, Crosby 2, Malkin 3, Austin Matthews 4. Are you surprised by that?
I am surprised that he was ranked that high this soon, but I don't necessarily disagree with it. Because I'm looking down the list. I mean, who's five? Backstrom. Well, we saw Nicklas Backstrom play in a pretty important playoff series this past spring. Was I blown away by Nicklas Backstrom? I certainly was not. I don't know about you.
No, I didn't think he had a great round, great playoff. He has been very consistent throughout his career. What these guys behind Matthews have is a track record.
Consistency,
right? They have consistency. Tavares is 6. Stamkos, who's had injury problems, 7. Seguin, 8. Getzlaf, 9. Scheifele, 10, which is a bit surprising. But he's an under-the-radar guy. He's a very good player.
But to me, I look at all those guys that Matthews is ranked ahead of, and Matthews, to me, has a quality they don't have. There's a game-breaking quality. There's a phenom quality that I think he's closer to being a guy who's considered a rival to a McDavid and a Crosby than a guy who's going to be lumped in with the rest of the best in class. I think, like, he's going to blow by the end of next season. You will not mention Austin Matthews and Nick Backstrom in the same sentence, in my opinion.
I don't see that either. I think if he grows on what he did this past year, and I think he will, that's natural. Players, great talents, they keep growing.
Right.
He had 40 goals and 69 points as a rookie. Took over the league opening night, had that knack for scoring the biggest goals. I mean, 4 opening night, he scores the OT winner on January 1st. Look what he did in the playoffs, where he scored 4 goals and really was a non-factor the first couple, but picked up as the series went on and started scoring big, big goals. He has, I think, a goal-scoring ability that is above and beyond anyone on this list, short of maybe Stamkos. But Stamkos hasn't been scoring like that recently.
And really isn't a center.
According to his own coach. He's on top of his... Yeah, when he's really suited properly to go out there and execute and produce at a high level, Stamkos is generally on the wing. McDavid is a better player, but he's not a better goal scorer. Crosby scored a lot of goals last year. I believe he led the league.
Won the Rocket Richard.
Has that ability to do it. But I would argue, just based on pure natural goal scoring talent, Matthews has more of it than Crosby.
Wow.
Crosby's got a better overall game, better skater, maybe better vision, but Matthews purely scoring, I think he's 40-plus a year, is almost a lock if he's healthy.
Why wouldn't he be? I mean, he was billed as a shoot-first center, and you know he's lived up to the billing. And it's not just, like, the thing I like about him is, Wendell Clark talked about this when Matthews broke that Wendell Clark rookie record. He talked about how it's not just, you know, top shelf snipes. Like he finds a way to beat the goalie, whether it's just a little backhander or it's just a little feathery forehander. It's not about just shooting it hard.
No,
he can shoot it hard.
He's like in the crease for goals too. He's a mucker and a grinder type goal scorer if need be.
If need be. And he can fire it with the best of them as well. But it's not just about that Ovechkin, you know, top shelf, you know, Stamkos top shelf one timer all the time. He's got a lot of looks, a lot of ways to get that puck beyond the goalie. And that to me is the thing that probably bodes the best for his consistency, because he's not just doing it one way. It's not like you can just say, let's take that away from him. Like when they take that opposite weak side dot away from Ovi, you know, and Stamkos, who got so good at that one timer and scored a lot of goals on it. Well, good defenses figure out a way to make you do something else. And with Matthews, there's nothing you can identify other than try and stay with him. Well, good luck.
No, I don't think he has a prototypical goal that he scores where you're like, to your point, Ovi, it's top of the dot, one-timer, he owns it. Stamkos had that for the longest time. I think Patrick Laine is kind of developing that as an outside shooter that can get it off, put mustard on it, and place it properly. But Matthews has a one-timer that he doesn't use as much, but has a snapshot. I remember when he went those 12 or 13 games without a goal, and he broke out in New Jersey. And if you go back and look at those two goals, they were both ugly.
Yeah.
They were in front of the net. He won a battle, and he tapped them in. And it doesn't matter how. It's just how many.
And it's the quick release, too. I remember talking to a number of players in the league pointed out when I asked them what impressed them about Matthews mid-season. They were talking about how, you know, he can get that puck with his hands way out in front of him in, like, and like no time, you know, on his side. Like he can't, there's no time to load it, no time to cradle it. And yet, even with the hands way out in front, he can find a way to just rip that thing in a way that very few guys can rip it.
Yeah, this would be about where I would have him.
Yeah.
I would have him for, I think, clearly McDavid and Crosby ahead of them. Malkin had a brilliant year last year, and he's got that pedigree. He's got Hart trophies, he's got Art Rosses, he's got Conn Smythe. They've won back-to-back Cups based on his prowess, Crosby's prowess.
But 31 years old, yeah, how long is that going to last?
I wouldn't be surprised if at the end of the year we looked at it differently, yeah, because Malkin's had ups and downs the past 5 or 6 years,
sure,
too.
He has.
He's gone up and down the list because of injury or because of a lack of performance based on the standards that he set early in his career. But I would have Matthews around 4. Now, the Hockey News came out with their top 50 players going into the season. They had Matthews at 8. They had McDavid 1, Crosby 2, Carlson 3. I think that's how I would rank it, too, the top 3. As of now, I would go McDavid 1, Crosby 2, Carlson 3, mm-hmm, Kane 4, Price 5, Bobrovsky 6. That's recency bias because he had a spectacular year last year, but do I expect him to be 6 at the end of next year? Not a chance.
He's had some stinker years, too, very recently.
Yeah, I don't think he's deserving of that billing, but Malkin 7, Matthews 8. Now, we mentioned Ovechkin a moment ago. Ovechkin ranked 36th on their list, and I can't say I'm surprised by that.
No.
And I can't say I would have them differently. Maybe I'd have them 32, 33 if I took time to break it all down. But his play has fallen off. His 5-on-5 play has fallen off. His ability to be that guy who takes over a game. I remember talking about it constantly throughout the first round.
Yeah.
Like, this is when they were down 2-1, I'm like, this has to be Ovi's night. Played 15 minutes and got benched at times.
I was going to say, Barry Trotz made him an afterthought so often.
Was on the third line by the end of
the
series.
And then took heat for it and then started playing him more, which was kind of strange, too. Like, stick to your guns, Barry. If you believe you shouldn't play, don't play him. Don't listen to the media. But you're right. I mean, he's not the same player. And there's a guy who looks to be falling off that cliff because he was the definition of explosive, wasn't he? I mean, he was the essence of NHL explosiveness. Until very recently.
Well, and for a decade, he was top 3 on this list every single year.
Yeah.
Every year.
And yet, threatened in the way he used to. Like, he wasn't the game-breaking threat that he used to be. And I don't think that's coming back.
No, I don't see him moving up the list.
No.
I just see him moving back.
I don't think that's inconsistency. I think that's a guy who's getting into his 30s, has had a reputation of not taking care of himself particularly well.
Plays
at
a
times.
Heavy game,
plays
posts
a heavy
body
game,
around a lot, takes
was
contact.
Carrying a lot of weight around. You know, the midsection isn't as trim and slim as the state-of-the-art guys.
Yep.
It certainly are, you know, and so I think that catches up to you when you get into your 30s.
Matthew's the only leaf on this top 50, which I think is justified. I think Nylander and Marner would make a case for pushing into the top 50.
But they lack the track record.
But they lack the track record. That's the outlier between them and Matthews, is that Matthews also lacks it. They both played the same amount of games, but he made such an impact and was so explosive and ran away with the Calder in what was a very good rookie year.
It was.
Very good rookie year. And Laine's 24 on this list. Jack Eichel's 25 on the list. But I wouldn't be surprised if Nylander and Marner continue to grow and evolve, that this time next year they're in the top 50. The Leafs have 3 guys in the top 50, and once they get in there, I wouldn't be shocked if they're all in there for 5, 6, 7 years.
Well, it's a tough list to crack, right? When you add in all the goalies and defensemen, you know, you got guys like Leon Draisaitl's 28, and you could say not much of a track record, but you know,
I'm surprised he's that.
That's a little high for me,
or high, whichever way you want to phrase it.
So, but you know, is Doug this list is
like Dougie Hamilton
at 39? I'm not sure I buy that one.
Yeah, I mean, each team just based on the numbers would have about 1.5, 1.6 players,
right?
You know, so each team should have anywhere between 1 and 2 players on it. And yeah, Hamilton, I mean, he actually had statistically a good year, and his second half was solid, but it's all subjective, right?
It
like,
is.
Should he be ahead of Roman Josi? Should he be ahead of Chris Letang? If you're looking ahead, yeah, he had injury problems, but Letang's a better player than Dougie Hamilton, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah,
if they're healthy,
I'll tell you what. Here's one that raises my eyebrows: is Jonathan Toews at 12? Is he really that player anymore? I mean, when you look, he's untouchable. I understand in terms of legacy. I mean, to win 3 cups, to be an integral member of gold medal teams of both the World Junior and the Olympics. But
his game
let's take stock here. 58 points last year. 58 points the year before.
Kucherov 14th. And Kucherov was a legit superstar last year and carried a depleted Tampa team and almost got them in.
So, I mean, look, Jonathan Toews is a legend, and there's no question, but 29 years old, not putting up the kind of points he used to put up, and it really was never a goal scorer, or a real producer.
No, but was a 30-goal scorer, 7-point guy, and just a that 200-foot player type that
and
you love.
And still is, I understand. But is he really the 12th best player in the NHL anymore?
No, I wouldn't have him 12
on my
list.
I don't think he is.
No, I wouldn't. There'll be a lot more of that between now and the beginning of the season. TSN will come out with their top 50 players as well, and we'll see where it all shakes out. I think McDavid, Crosby, Carlson is a lock for top three. It may differ based on your opinion. If you say Crosby's the best player in the game, I'm not going to yell and scream about it. If you put Carlson one, I wouldn't yell and scream.
Oh, with the playoffs, Eric Carlson.
Any of those three players.
The playoffs that Carlson's coming off of, I mean, you can make the case he is the best singular player in the league. I mean, I don't think it's hard because just the way he carried that team.
The amount of minutes
he logged and the impact he made in those games. Mm-hmm. It's hard to make a case anybody was better in the playoffs.
Well, that would be an interesting debate looking over the history of the game. When was the last time there were three guys where you're like, I pick your poison. I'm not sure how I would rank it. And if you asked 100 hockey fans or even people within the game, 100 hockey guys within the game, rank it 1, 2, 3, McDavid, Crosby, Carlson, I'll bet you get a variety of answers.
I think you would, because there's certain coaches who take the D-man, right? If they had to start the team, they would take the D-man as their centerpiece over the centerman.
Yeah.
I guarantee you.
I might myself. I mean, if I thought about it more, I think I would take McDavid first if I was building a team. He's the youngest of these three. But if it was simply for one season, I think Carlson is the most valuable player in the league to their respective team. Yeah. Goaltenders aside, like Bobrovsky was so magical, put up unbelievable numbers, can impact a game and a team more than anyone just based on the position, like a pitcher, like a quarterback. But taking goaltenders out of it for a moment, Carlson plays 30 minutes a night, does everything, and controls the game all over the ice.
That's what I mean. The impact
he is
a guy like that.
Valuable guy.
You can make that case. I mean, and you know what? If I was betting on durability, I might take a guy named Matthews over a guy named McDavid, just because I think his outlook as a guy who's going to try and stay injury-free in a league where injuries are rampant, I like it better than McDavid's.
He is bigger. He's thicker.
And he skates like a ballerina. He's such a beautiful skater at that size. Stays out of trouble.
Well, McDavid can skate recklessly.
That's what I mean.
Like, recklessly fast.
It scares me every time he does.
Yeah. And he gets wound up, and you're like, whoa, dude, slow down.
Yeah. Like, where you never get that feeling with Auston Matthews. You always feel like he's in perfect control at all times. And I know things happen out there, and I'm not wishing anything on anybody here, but I'm saying, if I was a GM, that's got to come in to your factors here. It's got to come into your reasoning about who would I want long-term and who has the best chance to be healthy long-term in this crazy league where so many guys lose so much time to injury.
We'll recap a busy afternoon next. All right, Dave, we survived the solar eclipse. We can move on with our life.
That stuff, that whole space guy, science guy,
fake news
hype, fake news.
You were fake news.
Yeah.
That's what it was.
And Trump, of course, became the star of the show. Like, what were the odds that Donald Trump would become the star of the solar eclipse?
90% going in?
Wasn't that high?
I think it was pretty high.
I thought he was going to take a day off.
I don't think so, man.
No.
Not Trump. All right, buddy. I think we'll do this again later in the week.
Let's do it.
All right, Dave Pullen will be here tomorrow. I'm Brian Hayes. We're out of here. Enjoy your evenings. We're back tomorrow at 4 p.m. We'll chat then.